This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and today many of us are back to work or back to school for the first time in 2017. And even if you made some resolutions for this new year, come next week, you may find it hard to stay motivated to reach your goals. Motivation is a tricky thing. It's something Dan Ariely's thought a lot about. He's a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke and the founder and director of the Center for Advanced Hindsight in Durham. He's the author of a number of best-selling books. His latest book is called Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. Dan Ariely is my guest this hour in the studio. Welcome back. Always good to have you here.
Wonderful to be back.
Happy New Year. And we're taking calls and emails this hour as well. If you need help motivating yourself, wonder what motivation is, why have you tried and failed, how does it work, or if you're an employer trying to come up with new ways to help your workers become more effective employees, or if you thought about motivation in the workplace, that's all good. Dan will talk about it at 877-962-9862, 877-962-9862 if you want to talk with Dan Ariely today. SOT@WNC.org is our email address, and tweet us at SOT Live. So, Dan, this book, you start out with a story that you tell, and we've told the backstory about your very serious burns when you were a teenager. But this, your book begins with a story about having to revisit those in some ways because you were asked to visit a burn victim in a hospital.
Yeah. Actually, it was. Because I wrote about my injury in many of my other books and I've been kind of so explicit about it, I get about once a week somebody with an injury writes me. And it happens a lot, and I talk to a lot of people like this. And usually what people want to know is, like, how would life look afterward? How do you... when you get injured badly, it's very easy to see what you've lost. It's very hard to figure out what you're going to gain and how is life going to be afterwards. So I have lots of discussion like this. But this one was particularly painful. And it was particularly painful, first of all, because the people involved were burned. So the same kind of injury that I had, very badly. And because the mother of the two kids that were burned asked me lots of very difficult questions. She didn't start by asking me questions about the future. She started by asking me about the injury. So the basic story was that I was at dinner and I got a phone call, and the phone call was from a friend of this mother who I didn't know, but she knew who I was, and she asked me to go to the hospital to visit this mother. And only when I got to the hospital, I learned what happened. I learned that her two kids were very, very badly burned. And her first set of questions was, what would they want to know? What would they want to know? And, she asked me so many questions that we don't have answers for. But so I was trying to put myself back into this state of being in hospital with machines and pain and people coming in. And I was trying to kind of figure out what I wanted to know. And in particular, what I told her was that I wanted to know what the different sounds symbolized, which ones are saying that things are well and which one are not. You know, heart monitor. Sometimes it means the sounds are good and sometimes right. It means it's not so good. I want to know what will happen to my pain. When will I have a period of relief? When will it be painful? Kind of just have some sense of control, understanding what's going on. And I left after a few hours, but then a couple of days later she called me again, and in a very kind of crying voice just said, please come quickly. And when I came, I learned that one of her son passed away. You know, burns are very, very tough for the system, and lots of people with deep injuries, it's very hard to stay alive with this. And her question, which was very, very difficult, was to ask me, what should she tell the other son? Whether she should tell him that his brother died, or whether she should tell him that, not tell him. And again, I was trying to kind of figure out how can you even digest news like this in a state of a coma and going in and out of consciousness. Not coma, but going in and out of consciousness and pain and so on. I told not to tell him, and not to tell him for as long as possible. But then two more things happened. The first one was that a few months later, she asked me to write her son an optimistic note about the future. And actually, that got me to cry a lot, because I wasn't really optimistic about his future. I knew that even though he was past the stage of immediate threat to his life, that he had a really, really long, painful path. You know, I'll be 50 this year. I'll be 50 in a few months. I got injured 32 years ago, and I still had surgery last year. You know, this is a long time. It takes it's not like a burn that you get on your finger and a few weeks later you're back to normal. It's a very different kind of an injury, and I didn't know what to tell him, and it took me a while to kind of figure out how to be honest, but not brutally honest. Right. And how to leave some hope, but not to be over-optimistic. And I told him that technology has mostly helped people with disabilities, that it helped everybody, but it really helps us the most, that we don't all have to be a 9-to-5 workers with the same kind of skills, that we can figure out what we can do and specialize in that niche. But I also told him that life will be more difficult. But the most important lesson for me from that the whole thing was that when I went to see him in hospital again a few months later, and I didn't know how it was, because the previous times I saw him, he was kind of in and out of consciousness. We didn't really get to talk, but this was a visit to come in and talk to him and spend time with him. And I was actually worried about what it will be like. I've been back to the burn department a lot as a patient coming back, but not to visit people. And half an hour into it, I was kind of pleasantly surprised. I was kind of saying to myself, this is going well. We talked about life. I was telling him about things I was doing. He was telling me a little bit about hospital. It was kind of a nice discussion. But then maybe 2 hours later, a nurse came in and she told him he was going to have a new treatment today. And I remember that treatment. And he tried to negotiate. He said, can I do it tomorrow? And she said, no. And he said, can I do it in a few hours? She said, no. In an hour? No. In half an hour? No. Can I do it to part of my body? No. Can I do it just on my legs? No. And that was a part that I couldn't stand. I was just became weak in the knees. It was kind of, I sat down and I put my head between my knees and I was just kind of trying to breathe, because I just remembered all my own attempts to try to negotiate with pain and treatments. And I quickly left afterward. I mean, we keep on talking. I just sent him a message yesterday. But what I realized is how much of the life in hospital and injuries are really about lack of control. That I used to think about, I still think about the pain and the challenges and so on is one part of it. But I think that the lack of control is just incredibly tough. Like just being things done to you without any part of it. And I'm not sure that, you know, being able to negotiate exactly. Like when would somebody say, I want pain today, right? It wouldn't happen. Right. But this lack of control that what we do to people is incredible. And you know, and the reason I start this book on motivation with this story is partially to talk about the importance of control and a sense of purpose, but partially it's because I was reflecting about my own life, that, you know, I expose myself to a lot of pain. I talk to people with injuries, with this kid and his mother. I went to see them a lot. You know, it feels as if you came from the outside world, you would think that I want misery. That the kind of thing I'm craving is pain and difficulty and crying and so on. And it's, of course, not true. But what those experiences, and this one in particular, gives me is a different sense of, I don't want to call it joy because it's not joyful, but it's a different sense of fulfillment that you don't get by joy. So when we have this thing called the right to pursue happiness, and people think, what is happiness? People often think it's about, you know, sitting on a sofa, drinking beer, watching a game, or, you know, whatever. But it's short-term happiness. But lots of the things that we really have the right to pursue are not about the long-term, not about short-term happiness. They're about long-term something that actually often comes at the expense of short-term happiness.
Well, I think that, yeah, your story certainly illustrates two of those points, and we'll talk about them in more detail as the conversation continues. But one, certainly how giving anyone a sense of power or control over their environment might be a very powerful motivator, perhaps more, and some of your research suggests that, perhaps more than a material benefit, than a one-time material benefit, more money, more benefits. Control is one thing, but also your willingness to take on something that is inherently unpleasant, anything that we would normally avert, right? We would have an aversion to going back to a hospital if we spent that much time, but you found some sense of fulfillment in going into, you know, facing the pain, and how that in some ways can be fulfilling and rewarding.
Yeah, and you know, it's this is an extreme example, but think about something that lots of people do, like running a marathon.
Right.
If you came from outer space and you looked at people running a marathon, you would say, who punished them, right? What have they done to deserve this? But the reality is we pursue all kinds of things that give us a different sense of happiness than the short-term happiness.
We will find out more about those and what the research shows when my conversation with Duke Professor Dan Ariely continues. His new book is called Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. And you can join us at 877-962-9862. Tweet us at hashtag SOTLive or send us an email, sot@wnc.org. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio talking today with Dan Ariely. Dan Ariely is a best-selling author of books about behavioral economics, including Predictably Irrational. His new book called Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations, and it accompanies his TED Talk on the subject. Dan is taking your calls. If you have questions about motivation, staying motivated, it can be New Year's resolutions. You can talk about motivation at work. Give us a call, 877-962-9862, email at sot@wnc.org, or tweet us at hashtag SOTLive. And we've got some calls right now, so why don't we go right to the phones. We'll talk to Laura in Carrboro. Hello, Laura.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I'm calling because it's actually on behalf of someone else and how to motivate someone else to want to be happier. My younger brother has overcome or, you know, forced to overcome through probation a pretty serious and long-term addiction to hallucinogenics. And now he is just very despondent and seems to really have given up. And I don't know how to encourage him to keep going.
Okay, Laura, thank you.
So I'll tell you another story. There was a guy who called me about 2 years ago. He wrote me a very quick email, said, please call me. I called him. It was a guy that became a quadriplegic a year earlier. And on that day, basically, a year after you get injured, he kind of realized that he was not going to get better. And he wanted to talk about what he does now. And we kind of talked about what he's good at, what he could do, and we came up with some plan. And then he asked me about what do we think about committing suicide. I said, I'm not against it, but we just came with some other options. Let's check them first. And we would talk once a week about the progress he was making, and 4 months later he did commit suicide. And since then I started talking to a lot of quadriplegics. And my interest has been like try to understand what gets some people to be resilient and some people to give up. And one of the lessons I've learned is that the resilient people switch their focus of attention from the meaning of life to small victories. So one of the quadriplegics I talked to, for example, he asked his caretaker to lay his clothes on the floor and he wiggles himself into his clothes. He tries to dress himself. He has a stick and he tries to move it with his shoulder, and it takes him about 45 minutes to get dressed. You could say, like, somebody could just dress you. Why do 45? But no, he makes small victories. He times himself and he looks at life this way. And I think, you know, in all kinds of things in life, whether you look at politics or an injury or a state and so on, as long as you keep your objective about the big meaning of life, it's really hard to get motivated because, you know, what kind of progress could you make? So in your case, or in your brother's case, I think that trying to define what small victories mean, trying to time things, trying to focus, trying to basically divert things from life without hallucinogenics, which is probably a much sadder way to live, to try and point it into some smaller things that are achievable on a daily basis is one important way to go.
It seems to me, too, that what you're saying is, and maybe what some of these challenges that we face in our daily lives, and sometimes they're sort of once-in-a-lifetime challenges, bring us face-to-face with ideas about our values that maybe we've never even examined before. Ideas about what success looks like and what's expected of us. And as long as things are going along just fine, we never really thought about what people were expecting of us or what made us happy. But when a lot of that's taken away, then I guess you're forced to say, well, maybe that wasn't a realistic approach anyway. And what is my life about and what's my happiness going to look like?
And that's very tough. Tough to kind of pave your own path.
Right.
The other thing with drug addiction is that people who've used drugs for a while define their social environment this way. And it's not just the drug itself. It's a part of who they are, yeah, part of who their friends are, what they do for a living, what they do for life and so on. Another thing to think about is what we call reward substitution. And reward substitution is this idea that instead of thinking about something in the long term, you try to replace it with some short-term incentive for something good. So, my own example, I love coffee. My first cup of coffee in the morning is a lovely cup of coffee. And what I've done is I've made it into a ritual. I come to the office, I listen to the beans being grinded, I watch it, I smell it, I take the cup with me to my office. And what's very easy to do when you come into the office the first thing in the morning is to open email and, respond to some unimportant emails or to check Facebook or stuff like that. But I've also committed that with this wonderful cup of coffee, I also work on something that is important for me for the day. So what I do is I take this long-term reward, there are things I want to work on, and I basically connect it to a short-term reward. So it's a long-term task, like working on a book or grading papers or whatever it is, and connecting it to something fun that I want. So another thing you could do is you could see with your brother what are the things that do give him some joy and how you connect those things that give him to joy to things that are good for him in the long term. So you say, what if you make some progress on work, or you can make some progress on gardening or whatever. Things that don't necessarily are fun for you at this moment but are good for you in the long term, can you connect them to things that are good, that are fun for you in that?
But sometimes this hooking up with the long term and even having a vision of a long term for some of us can be very, very difficult. Melissa might have some thoughts on this, who is joining us now by phone from Chapel Hill. Hello, Melissa.
I'm a pre-health student and would like to know what medical professionals can do to help motivate patients to take control of their health care and help give them a sense of security and control in care.
Thanks, Melissa.
Yeah, so first of all, a lot. It actually shocks me to realize how little healthcare professionals understand motivation. So I was recently in a talk about diabetes, and they mentioned that... it was a talk about hypertension. And they were talking about how what improvement in hypertension will be if people took their medications all the time, and they estimate it will be about 20% compared to 80% if people start exercising and eating well, right? So you think to yourself, like, what's going on? The reality is that most of stuff in the healthcare system that we could do are kind of simple, and we all know them. It's not simple. Eating better, exercising, sleeping, and taking our medication, that's basically lots of things in medicine would be much better, but we don't really understand how to get this done. Now, in terms of how to motivate people, there's lots of tricks about it. What we know for sure is that simply telling people what to do doesn't work. And it's as if we, as people, don't care about our long-term well-being. I mean, that's how we behave, right? Just think about texting and driving, right? Most people admit to be texting and driving, which is incredibly stupid. And everybody knows it's incredibly stupid. It's not only illegal, and not only you can kill other people, you can kill yourself. But nevertheless, we do it. We're just not that good in thinking about our long term. So what can we do? We can get into better habits. Habits are nature's way to get us to do things that are, you know, either good or bad for us, but to do things without thinking about them. So how do we get people to create good habits? We have recently done some research on rituals, not just habits, but how do you take things and ritualize them? And we show that this actually makes people even more likely to stick to good behavior. How do you get people accountable? Accountable to their family members, accountable to themselves. How do you get people to feel a loss when they don't do something? So there's lots of ways to do things. I'll just give you one last trick, which is getting people to commit to a very specific action plan. So if you say something general, like, I will eat better, when exactly are you violating it? Every time you take an extra bite and so on, it's just really unclear. The moment you have a very particular action plan that says, every day I will start the day with this particular meal and I'll eat a fruit, and, you know, you have something very, very specific, it's clear to you whether you're on this side of the fence or not. Are you behaving according to the plan or not? And it's much easier to adhere to the rules.
You've also done some experiments in the corporate realm. Maybe you can talk about the Intel experience mm-hmm. that you had. And this is sort of getting people motivated and trying to increase productivity and ways in which material benefits. Because, again, what you're talking about is a kind of a short term. I need to feel something now
yep.
because knowing that I may not have a stroke 10 years from now, it's just hard for me to feel. And it's certainly not as good as that bite of donut, which I felt instantly. So can I get an instant gratification to replace the long-term pain? And they do this in the corporate world. Talk about the Intel experiment.
Yeah. So lots of attempts in the corporate world, but also there has been some attempts in healthcare, is to just pay people. There was a study that Humana, the big health insurance company, basically paid people to take their flu shots. Right. So this was a study with Intel, the chip manufacturer, and it was in a production facility when people would come for 4 days to work very long shifts, 12 hours a day, and then they would have 4 days off, 4 days on, 4 days off, and so on. And what Intel has been doing for a long time is to take the first day of the shift and to give people a goal and to say, if you produce today, let's say, 1,300 chips, you'll get $30. If you produce less, you'll get zero. If you produce 1,300 chips, you'll get $30. And then the next day, there was no target and no bonus, no target, no bonus, no target, no bonus, 4 days off and back to the first day with a target and a bonus. And their logic for doing this was to say, people just come off 4 days off. They're not kind of on top of things. Let's kind of get them in the right way. And when me and kind of a couple of colleagues heard about this, we said, let's add a control condition. What's a control condition? A control condition is a condition where you do nothing. Let's just compare it. See if it's working well, not well, and so on. And they said, sure, let's do it. So then we said, okay, let's try something else. Let's try to give people the same target, but instead of giving them money, let's send them pizza at home. And we said, pizza will be a gift rather than money, and will also make them heroes in the eyes of their families. Let's see how that would work. Well, after long discussion, it turns out that was too complex for the HR department of Intel to send pizza. But they agreed to give people a voucher for a pizza. Not the same as pizza, but, you know. And then we said, what about the fourth condition in which people get a compliment from the boss, a text message? They said, okay. We originally wanted like a live compliment, but we settled for a text message. So here's what happened. They would come on that first day of the shift. Let's just call it a Monday. A quarter of the people were told nothing. A quarter of the people were given a goal, 1,300 chips. If you get to it, you will get $30. A quarter of the people were given a goal, you'll get a voucher for pizza. A quarter of the people were given a goal, if you'll make it, you'll get a nice text message from the boss. What happened? On that first day of the shift, all three conditions did better than the control. The money did slightly worse than the other two, but they all did much better.
The money did slightly worse.
Slightly worse. Okay, slightly worse. Slightly.
But they all, yeah.
They all did quite well. The money did about 1% less than the other two, but they all did quite well. So if you just looked at that first day, it looks like any incentive works, and they all work basically the same. But what was interesting was what happened the next day. Now remember, the next day there was no target, there was no bonus, But was there any residue? And yes, there was a residue. What happened? In the money condition, performance went up on the first day, went down dramatically the next day below the control condition. It was as if people said, you know, yesterday you paid me, I was motivated. Today you're not paying me, I'm just not that interested. And performance went slightly up the next day, slightly up the next day, almost caught up to the control condition by the fourth day. And in total, by giving people $30 in bonuses, Intel lost 5% of productivity. By the way, 5% of productivity is a lot, yeah. And they paid for it. And right. What happened in the complement condition? Performance went up slightly more than the money condition on the first day of the shift and slowly went down. Pure benefit. It was just better than control.
Did it ever fall below the control?
Never went below.
So it was always better.
Yeah. Always better. Yeah. So it was dominating, yeah. Right? Always better. And the voucher for pizza was between the two. It was kind of almost halfway between the two. And I speculate that if the voucher for pizza looked more transactional, here's a $30 voucher for pizza, you can redeem it and so on, and here's the terms and conditions, it would look more like the money. And if it looked more social, here's a gift or appreciation for you and your family, please enjoy it with good health, it would look more like the text message. And the point is that we can think about incentives as doing two things. They kind of can motivate a very direct behavior. Please produce more chips right now. But they can also create or destroy goodwill. And the question is, do they also create or destroy goodwill? And goodwill is everywhere. If you think about jobs, think about how much we depend on goodwill. As a university professor, you know, of course, Duke depends on my goodwill a lot. I have tenure, which means that, you know, they can't fire me. I don't want to test it, but, you know, they can't fire me.
Yeah.
So it means that it's basically all about my goodwill. How much am I willing to invest and put effort and so on? And I'm doing a lot. I work very, very hard. But it is all about goodwill, and goodwill is a part of every job. And as we move into the knowledge economy, more and more jobs are more about goodwill. And the question is, what kind of incentives create goodwill? And the incentives that create goodwills are ones that are about long-term connection. If I have a contract with you that says, you know, Frank, we'll pay you by how many words you talk, or by how many calls you get, or, you know, how many listeners. Yeah. We did something like that it's about today.
Mm-hmm.
How would it change your motivation? Versus we say, you know, the station depends on you. It's not just about your show. You're part of the station in general, you're part of the Chapel Hill Durham Triangle community. You know, how would you feel then about your connection? So if you think about the things that you read and think about and try to explore and think, all of those things are goodwill. And I can easily imagine a situation in which the way that you get paid or rewarded or given compliments or goals even could either increase your goodwill or decrease it.
877-962-9862, the number to call if you want to join our conversation with economic behavioralist and Dan Ariely, who's here from Duke to talk about that and motivation in his new book, Payoff. But does it? We do these things in averages, but it seems to me that different people respond to different motivations. I mean, that has to be clear. If you look at some of the people who smashed the system, you know, in 2008, there's something wrong with those guys, right? I mean, they weren't even in it for the money. It was about gambling. It was about power. And it seems to me that how you would motivate them, because they had enough money, would be different than a line worker at Intel.
You know what? I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure. So first of all, to finish the previous thought, you know, one of the things we did with the No Child Left Behind policy was to basically take teachers who thought about education and the next generation and their mission in education and so on, and basically said, all we care about is the results of this test. And we created lots of bad incentives. And if you look at teachers and you look at people in Wall Street, not so different. I'm not saying the people are the same, but we got teachers to cheat a lot on tests. We got lots of terrible incentives. So, look, over the years, I've been teaching a lot of kids. And I had students, undergrads, who could have, they were deciding between medical school and Wall Street. And, you know, some went this way and some went that way. And the people who went to Wall Street became Wall Street people. The people who went to medicine became physicians. I don't think it's so much about the people. I think if I took you and I put you in Wall Street, in a few weeks, you will become competitive.
If I wasn't that guy to begin with, we're going to take a break here in a second. If I wasn't that guy to begin with, wouldn't I fail? I'd never get to run Lehman Brothers because I couldn't do it. Clearly somebody's going to get hurt here. No. Or I just don't have the guts or the brains. But, I mean, temperamentally, I wouldn't be suited. I'd be out. I wouldn't make it through the upper ranks and be the running Lehman Brothers.
You know what? You might not make it to running it, but the question is, would you be as motivated? Would you start measuring your own success? You see, because what happens with money on Wall Street, it's not just about greed.
Yeah.
It is about how people measure themselves.
That's right.
And their competitiveness and so on. And I think that if I put you in that environment, it might take a few weeks, but you'll be a very different person very, very quickly. Quicker than you want to imagine.
That I guarantee. Certainly be a different person, but it takes a certain kind of person to thrive in that that competitive environment and then make it to the top based on competition alone without regard to anything else.
So,
I'm guessing. Let's take a break. Let's take a break. Come back. We'll take some phone calls, 877-962-9862, to talk with Dan Ariely, professor at Duke University, author of Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. Coming up on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Dan Ariely's in the studio this hour, professor at Duke, a best-selling author. He's sold many books, and his latest book on the market is one called Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations. We're talking about motivation today with Dan Ariely and taking your calls at 877-962-9862, emails at sot@wnc.org, and you can tweet us at hashtag SOTLive. We've got a call right now from Teresa from Chapel Hill. Hello, Teresa.
Hi. I was just recently diagnosed with diabetes, and it's kind of been fun. I'm using an app to track my food. It's making a game out of it and to see how the blood sugar changes. But how do I maintain that long term? The beginnings are always interesting and fun, and the New Year's resolution part of it. But how do you maintain that long term?
All right. Good question. Dan Ariely, what do we do?
Yeah. So first of all, I'm happy you're taking it with such a fun approach. It's not an easy disease to manage, and it requires management because, as you probably know, the path for deterioration is very, very, very tough. The things to do is to basically realize that if you had to make a decision all the time, you would fail. Not all the time, but you would fail often. Imagine I came anywhere and I layered people desks with donuts every morning. Every morning, a layer of fresh donuts on people's desk. Now, would people eat a donuts every day? Probably not. But from time to time, absolutely. And over time, it will certainly be a bad situation. So one of the lessons is to basically, rather than fight temptation, to figure out how we eliminate temptation from our path. If you remember the story from the mythology about Ulysses. Right. Ulysses knew that if the sirens will come, he will crash the boat. So what did he do? He got the sailors to tie him to the mast. This way he couldn't take any action. And he asked the sailors to put wax in their ears. And this way the sailors themselves were unaware that temptation existed. So part of the issue is to figure out how do you basically don't get tempted. The second part, though, is to try to figure out some good habits. So what do you do when you go shopping? You know, getting a shopping list that you use every week, making sure you don't deviate from that is also helpful. And then a last interesting one, there are many more, but a last one to think about here is the idea that accountability is important. Exercising, for example, we did a study a while ago where we showed that when people decided for themselves to exercise, they often canceled, right? They kind of had these very fuzzy goals, oh, I'll go to exercise, then they didn't. But if you have a friend who is meeting you in the street corner, you show up. And you show up not because you care about exercising, but because you don't want to disappoint a friend. So doing things that take advantage of our social bond and connection about being accountable to other people are often very helpful. So I'm not sure what's your family situation or your friend situation, but think about how you use your friends and family to hold you accountable to better health.
Accountability, social networks. You talk a lot about some of these, and you talked in our last segment, too, about sort of other factors beyond material rewards that work in motivation. And I think the study you did with Legos, Legos robots, is a pretty good example of that. Tell us about it.
Yeah. The study with Lego robots was really about kind of meaning of actions. And what we did was we kind of eliminated meaning from people. So here's the story. We gave people these Bionicles, robot, Lego robots, and we say, would you like to build the first one? And we'll pay you. Let's say we'll pay you $3 for the first one. People finish the first one. And then we said, would you like to build a second one for 30 cents less? And if they said yes, we gave them the next one. And then if they finished the second one, we said, would you like to build a third one for 30 cents less? So people worked for less and less and less and less and less money until they said, not worth my time. And we were interested in this break point. When will people say, not worth my time? This was what we call the meaningful condition. Now, we told people in this condition that at the end, we'll break all the Bionicles, we'll put them back into their boxes for the next participant. But we had another condition we called the Sisyphic condition or the meaningless condition. And in that condition, it started the same way. Would you like to build a Bionicle for $3? You said yes, you started building it, we took it back. And then we said, would you like to build another one for 30 cents less? If you said yes, you started working on the second. But as you were working on the second, we were taking apart the first one. So you got to work on something and got to see it destroyed in front of your eyes as you were working on the second. And then when you finished the second, if you said you want to do another one for 30 cents less, we gave you back the first, the one that you worked on and we destroyed and now you got to work on again. And this was this idea that one of the most demotivating things is to work and see our work being destroyed in front of our eyes. And in that condition, what happened is people stopped very quickly, right? And the other thing that happened was that we measured how much people love Lego in general. And in the first condition, there was a really beautiful correlation, large correlation between how much people love Legos and how much they persisted. Because you would expect that people who love Lego loved it more and persisted longer for low pay because you loved it more, right? It had more value for you. So maybe if you loved Legos, you would even do it for 20 cents. But if you don't, you will stop at $2. In the Sisyphic condition, the correlation went to zero, which means that we destroyed the joy people were getting out of Lego.
Sisyphic, meaning the myth of Sisyphus, rolling the rock up the hill and having to roll back. Yeah. But so it's fascinating. So people were continuing for less and less money, and the people who actually got paid more did less when they felt their work was meaningless.
That's right. So the moment something feels like it has no target, goal, meaning, something else, and you see it destroyed in front of you, you lose motivation. And if you think about the health example of this case, life toward maintaining health is full of bumps, right? From time to time, there are meals, we drink something, we do all kinds of things that are unhealthy for us. And then the tendency is what is called the what the hell effect, right? So imagine you're on a strict diet and then you start the morning and there's nothing to eat and you go to the office and there are muffins and you have a muffin. What often happens is you say, what the hell? I'm not a dieter. I've kind of disappointed myself for the day today. I'll start tomorrow. And of course, then you eat worse for the rest of the day. And for us, we kind of categorize ourselves as being good or not good. Right. And you could be like 92% good, but think of yourself as good. But if you're 70% good, you know why? You can't move back to close to 100. So you say, what the hell? I might as well enjoy life. And you move all the way to the other side. So how do we take these small bumps in the road not as personal failure and don't categorize us as just bad people? I'm not adhering today. I might as well not adhere at all.
But part of
forgive
that,
ourselves.
I mean, well, part of that, in terms of motivation, doesn't it come from the difficulty of not feeling, you know, you worked hard at it, you didn't eat a donut today, and you've gone for 3 weeks and you haven't had one, and then you do, the sense of not noticing the change that it produced in you.
Yeah.
The fact is it did. The fact is that you somehow withdrew from something that you wanted, knowing full well it would hurt you. It should have had some effect, but you didn't feel it, and you certainly didn't feel it the same way that sugar felt on your tongue.
Yeah, and that's a really big problem. So we're doing now some experiments on this in weight. So here's the thing. It's really good to weigh yourself. It's good to weigh yourself every morning because you kind of, it's not just the weighing, it's a commitment to saying, I'm going to try and maintain my weight. But weight fluctuates. Weight can fluctuate by 3 pounds a day, depending on how much salt you had and what time you woke up and whether you peed or not and other bowel movements. But we want people to lose at the rate of 2 pounds a month, where their daily fluctuation could be 3 pounds a day. So what happened is that the measurement has such high noise that it's demotivating. So maybe yesterday you went for a run and you ate only salad and you step on the scale today and you went up. And, you know, my digital scale can tell me if I went up by 0.2 of a pound.
That's right.
So, you know, right. I had this salad and running day and today I'm having a terrible day. It's terrible.
Yeah.
Right? So what happened is that as we get these more specific measures of health with decimals, two things happen. One is that we get lots of what's called loss aversion, right? That you get disappointing results.
Mm,
so loss aversion is the idea that we hate losing more than we enjoy gaining by about 2-to-1 ratio. Yeah. So in weight, loss is gain and gain is loss. But if you went on a scale and you have a bad day, it's really a bummer. Yeah. If you have a good day, it's slightly happy, but overall, it's a negative experience, right? Even if you just maintain your weight, but half the days are miserable and half the days are okay, happy, on the average, it's not good. And on top of that, it's really confusing. It's very confusing to realize that you had a salad and weight went up, or you had a cheesecake and weight went down. So a lot of this, what the caller is reporting, this gamification, is really nice for things that don't have a lot of randomness in them.
Hmm.
But for things that have randomness in them, we should focus on what we do, not on the outcome.
And that's something that's measurable. It's day 4, no donut. Day five of a healthy diet. Day six.
Right.
And so I can measure that, not a lot of noise, and that can be a success every day that I do it. And you can also discount the days off, like a donut is a third of a day.
Friday donut or something like that. But looking at our actions rather than outcomes is incredibly important for motivation.
Let's go to the phones now. Napoleon is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Napoleon.
Hi, how you doing? And thanks for taking my call. You spoke about the importance and value of goodwill and accountability. How do you think the hidden logic or motivations and the goodwill or lack thereof of the president-elect will affect the U.S. and the world as a whole, and who will hold him accountable?
And there we go. Napoleon, thanks for the call. Predictions for, the apocalypse in 2017. Or maybe not.
So
could be a good year.
I'll tell you a couple of my challenges. So in addition to studying motivation, I've been studying dishonesty for a very long time, and this political season in general was full of dishonesty, and the idea that you can be dishonest in a public way and not be called for it and not feel regret was heartbreaking. And it's heartbreaking not just to see it, it's also because we know that dishonesty is socially contingent. So whatever happens in this election, the next election will start from this point. It will not start from scratch. We also found that Americans wanted their politicians to be dishonest. And we wanted our politicians to be dishonest, not because we value dishonesty. In fact, we wanted the politician on the other side of the aisle to be honest. We just wanted our politician to be dishonest because we wanted them to balance the policies we care about with dishonesty, and we care more about the outcome, about the policy. So people on the left want policies for global warming. People on the right want to abolish the Healthcare Act. Whatever it is, people are willing to sacrifice honesty for that. So that's one thing. The other thing that really worries me is conflicts of interest. One of the things we know about conflicts of interest is that we're kind of blind to them. We don't see how conflicts of interest are influencing us. And this administration so far is creating an unprecedented amount of conflicts of interests, not just with Trump's decisions of his own life, but also with the people that he's choosing. And you don't have to be a bad person to have conflicts of interest influence you in deep ways that you yourself don't understand, but influence you dramatically nevertheless. And I just see conflicts of interest everywhere, and it worries me a lot.
Well, and we all will. And as you say, the dishonesty was public and became, in fact, it turned into a virtue in this campaign. Criminal behavior was turned into a virtue by the supporters. You talked about honesty being contingent.
Contingent. I mean, what I meant was to say that when we see other people behaving dishonestly.
And you've done, well, I want to talk about the research because you've actually done research that shows that when it's permissible, there's far more, so that honesty isn't a sort of an absolute virtue. It is a relative virtue.
Yeah. And so in some of our experiments, just quickly, what we've done was we had people in a big classroom basically do a test and grade themselves, and they got paid by the question, so they could cheat and grade themselves, and they in a way that they thought we couldn't tell how many questions they really solved correctly. And we had an actor that worked for us that basically very quickly said, "I solved everything," in a way that was clearly impossible. And what we saw was that influenced dramatically what other people were cheating, and mostly when people felt connected to that person. So in that particular experiment, it was at Carnegie Mellon University, and we had one student, the actor student, was pretending to be a Carnegie Mellon student or a University of Pittsburgh student. And when he was a University of Carnegie Mellon student, lots of more people cheated more. When he was a Pittsburgh student, people felt a little bit repelled by it. They basically said, "Oh, it's these other people who are cheating. We're not like that." So you know, the proposition here is that when we see people that we feel connected to cheat, it basically makes it socially permissible. When it's people who are not like us that we think of in a very bad way, then it doesn't affect us in the same way. But it's about the social acceptability. It's okay to talk this way. It's okay to behave this way. And it's not just dishonesty. But, you know, the caller asked, who is going to hold the government accountable? I have no idea.
Well, and we saw House Republicans want less accountability for ethics. They want to be less ethical. So I guess, yeah, that is a good question going forward. And if it's contagious, and particularly when the supporters, you feel that it's your side that's doing the dishonesty, and that gives you permission to be more dishonest yourself, the impact can be geometric. And it's
I also want to tie this to the beginning of our conversation. I told you about these quadriplegics that have kind of framed the meaning of life in more concrete small steps. This is how I'm thinking about my own life and politics. I'm saying, you know, yes, these are going to be very, very challenging times, but what are the small steps that I could do? What are the little things that I can take now so that people who are 16, 17 years old now will vote differently? What are the small things that we could do to change things in the face of this seemingly very bleak picture?
That is the challenge, and we will leave you with that. Dan Ariely, a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke, also the founder and director of the Center for Advanced Hindsight. His newest book is called Payoff, The Hidden Logic That Shapes Our Motivations, a companion to his TED Talk, which you can see at TED.com, and you can get a link to this conversation at stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton-Ormond, Katie Barron, and Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.